Welcome to another edition of Cool Stuff Ride Home. Marcus Path, joined once again by Reggie Rizzou. On today's episode, you'll soon have a place to refuel on that good old trip from Earth to Mars. Yeah, more details on the way. Early man may have built structures made of wood earlier than previously thought. And on this day in history, the first publicly funded library is formed. That's all coming up on Cool Stuff. Well, for most of my life, I've looked at the need to refuel a vehicle as a task relegated to Earth, meaning there's really no need for a refueling station on Mars or the moon because, well, who's that for? Well, that perspective appears to be a bit outdated now, as one Texas-based company has plans to build a spacecraft to orbit the Earth for the purposes of refueling other ships, thereby extending their mission life. The Southwest Research Institute in San Antonio intends to build and test a small demonstration craft as part of a $25.5 million project funded by the U.S. Space Force. The craft, dubbed the Astroscale Prototype Servicer for Refueling, yes, it's very easy to spit out, will carry hydrazine propellant from a depot, also in orbit, to spacecraft that are running low on fuel. The APS-R, for short, can service any spacecraft fitted with a compatible refueling port and should be ready for launch by 2026. Now, per Southwest engineer Steve Thompson, quote, "Running low on fuel is a common issue for spacecraft in Earth orbit. When they have expended all their fuel, their mission ends, even though the vehicle may be in otherwise excellent health. A refueling vehicle can extend those missions, and we can get additional lifetime out of spacecraft that are already in orbit," end quote. The APS-R will operate in geostationary orbit around the Earth, meaning it will follow a circular orbit in sync with the Earth's rotational period of 24 hours. Southwest will construct the small host vehicle over the next 16 months, and per their recent release, will carry maximum dimensions of 24 by 28 by 45 inches when stowed for launch. The total vehicle launch mass weighs just 437 pounds, including propellant. Quite light when you think about it. When the host spacecraft is complete, Southwest will integrate the Astroscale supplied payload and perform system level environmental testing to prepare the vehicle for launch.
If we do want to go out further into the stars, so to speak, we do need a refueling station in order to do that. I mean, the amount of fuel it takes just to get to space, you're using a lot of that just to get there, that if you want to extend out, there's got to be some way to refuel. And I expect this to actually keep going. You're going to have one right outside Earth orbit, one on the moon, one on Mars or near Mars. You know, you're going to have to keep going the further out you go.
Yeah, you're right, Reg. This feels like the next logical step for space travel. In fact, it feels like while not necessarily all that much of a wow factor associated with it, it is kind of a big step because, as the story indicated, a lot of current space missions and future missions will be extended because of this, which likely means we're going to have more quote-unquote traffic up there. And to your point, the further out we go, the more of these refueling ports or docks we're going to need. So maybe the first of many, perhaps, we'll see, but kind of exciting when you think about it, when we're just talking about a good old refueling station.
You know who's probably going to pay good money for that? NASA. I mean, they're going to be the ones footing the bill, I'm sure, for refueling out there. And now they don't have to put something out there. Instead, they're just going to pay to use the service. Unless they get some sort of discount or they don't have to pay because the U.S. Space Force funded the project. But I'm assuming Southwest Research Institute is going to get some fee or some money for using their product, because why else would they do it?
My only remaining question is, will they have hot dogs, coffee, soda available for anybody who might be looking to quench their thirst or ease the hunger a bit? You know, traditional convenience store.
As long as they're like day or week old hot dogs still spinning that thing and all shriveled, then we're good.
Hey, we could use a little fuel over here as well as one of those week old sandwiches you've prepackaged. That'd be great. Thanks.
Early humans may have been using wood to build earlier than we had thought. Researchers have now uncovered a simple structure from the Stone Age that may be the oldest evidence yet of early humans building with wood. In a study published by the journal Nature, the construction is basic. A pair of overlapping logs fitted together with a notch. It's nearly 500,000 years old and provides a rare look at how ancient human relatives were working with wood and changing their environments. Study author Larry Barham, an archaeologist at the University of Liverpool, said, quote, "It took me a while before I appreciated what we were looking at. It didn't look very nice, to be honest, but it is more complex than I had thought," end quote. With the wooden structure, the team also dug up a handful of wooden tools from a riverside bed that sits above a waterfall in Zambia. They think the cross logs could have been a base for a bigger structure like a walkway or a platform. According to Barham, usually wood rots quickly when it's exposed to elements, which leaves them with little evidence on how ancient relatives used the material. However, these materials were submerged in the river, which helped preserve them. When his team uncovered the logs in 2019, they were still able to see telltale signs that early humans had shaped them, like that notch that was carved out in the upper log, tapering off the ends, and leaving tool marks across the surface. Barham was surprised how good it looks, saying, quote, "Everything looks so fresh, you think it cannot be this old," end quote. To figure out how old it is, researchers used a new method called luminescence dating, which uses tiny materials in the sand to estimate how long materials have been buried. According to that technique, the log structure was made at least 476,000 years ago, while the wood tools are slightly younger, under 400,000 years old. That places the materials in a time before our species, Homo sapiens, evolved. They would have been another kind of early human cousin, possibly Homo heidelbergensis, which was around in Africa at that time. Some think that these ancient humans were putting effort into, quote, "the furniture of the site," end quote. It suggests they may have stayed a while or made repeat visits, not just roamed around as a band of hunter-gatherers. The researchers also said that just seeing a couple logs laid out may not seem overly exciting, but you should consider that it shows a different perspective from the usual stone tools that are often discovered, and to know what early versions of man were capable of, the fact that they, you know, are able to actually build with wood and not just use those stone tools.
Yeah, I can understand why on the surface most people are going, what's the big deal? We clearly see far more complex structures than this every day, but you have to take a step back and put yourself in the shoes of these individuals at the time and their mindset and the knowledge that they have, which is significantly less than what we have as a society these days. And to think about the fact that they finally made some sort of an achievement here and actually constructing something, simplistic as it may be, it really did represent a big step forward. And I'm not trying to be hyperbolic, but it kind of lays the groundwork for each subsequent step forward taken in overall architecture. And I know that might sound a little crazy to say, but I think it's true. You've got to crawl before you can run, as the old cliche goes.
And as simple as it sounds, putting that notch into the wood to make them fit together is actually, I think, a pretty complex thought. Me as a child, which I would think me as a child normally would be smarter than early man, but I wouldn't have thought of putting notches into things to combine them.
I don't know why that amuses me. Me as a child. Reggie as a child always just assumed he'd be smarter than early man.
I would think we had bigger brains than early man, right?
Maybe. I don't know why that's so funny, but
I'd like to see early man play the video games I played as a child. Come on.
Well, I also, okay, I guess I'm thinking about you as an infant or a toddler. When you say as a child, assuming you're smarter than early man.
I'm thinking more.
Did you ever play with Lincoln Logs?
I did. Okay. And, you know, that then I understood, you know, oh, notches make this work better. But if you just handed me some wood and say, make a wooden structure, I would just stack them. You know, there's a thought process to put notches in to make it, you know, more sturdy and stable, or however you want to put that.
Well, I also wonder, if you're just talking about logs, there's no way to stack them. They're cylindrical, so they're not going to sit on top of one another. So it did take someone stepping back going, how do we make this work? How about we carve a little notch here and then fit the two together? So we're laughing, we're having fun with this, but I think we're both saying the same thing. This is a pretty big deal when you think about the time that it occurred.
While libraries have been around a long time, it wasn't until April 9th, 1833, that the first tax-supported public library was approved in the United States. It was in Peterborough, New Hampshire. Before that, libraries were usually just accessible to the wealthy or those who were well-connected. The library in Peterborough was founded around the 1790s and only had a small collection of books. When Unitarian minister Reverend Abiel Abbott came to the area, he formed the Juvenile Library, the Ministerial Library, and Shares-Based Library with an annual dues of 0 cents. There were also a few other libraries in town as well. However, Abbott wanted a library for everyone, even if they weren't wealthy or connected. It was on April 9th, 1833, during a town meeting that it was proposed and approved that the town would have a library that was owned and operated using taxes from the citizens. When it opened, it only had 100 books. And at first, they were stored in the general store, then in the post office, finally at the pharmacy, which was located in the former town hall. By 1890, it had 6,000 books and more space was needed. A group of citizens got together and purchased a piece of land for a new library, but they still needed funds to build it. In 1891, two former residents, Nancy Smith Fosters and her cousin William H. Smith, agreed to give $10,000 and $5,000 towards the building. However, it was based upon their cousin, George S. Morrison, an accomplished engineer, that he should be the one to design and build a library. It finally opened in 1893. The library wasn't completely ready yet, though. There were no stacks, so residents had to request a book and the librarian would bring it to them. Most of those records from this time are still available in the library archives. Skip ahead to the near present time. In 2018, the town of Peterborough voted overwhelmingly in favor of a $3 million bond to support renovations to the structure. They ended up raising another $5.5 million with donations from individuals, businesses, organizations, and foundations. The new library restored many aspects of the 1893 building and had an expanded room for collections, adding a small room for meetings, a classroom, a large community function room, and collaborative spaces for all ages. That library has now grown to 43,000 titles, plus all of the electronic resources that libraries have now. So it's crazy to think that the first, you know, library that was available to the public had 100 books, now at 43,000 titles. And to me, this has to be a historical landmark. I don't see any way where you can tear this building down as how important it was being the first publicly funded library.
Oh, yeah. I think you've got to find a way to preserve that. I'm going to say something very similar to what I said during our last story. You have to consider the time in which this all took place. Quite frankly, when we say only 100 books, at that point in history, 100 books was probably a pretty big deal. That's a lot of books to be able to go over and page through and bone up on your knowledge, because remember, there is no internet. I know we all know that, but consciously think about that. There's no other way to learn new things short of going and taking a class somewhere. A library presents that opportunity for the first time to everyone in a community. It's not a private collection. It's not something that you think about when you watch a movie from that period of time where there's a huge mansion and you've got to roll the ladder out and the wealthy millionaire trots up four levels to pull down a book for someone. It really does, you know, take a step forward for just educating society in general. I can't help but wonder, when did library culture develop outside of this? Meaning, when did we have the first librarians shushing everyone to stay quiet while people sat there and read?
When did that Dewey Decimal System come into play to librarians to put all the books away in the right place? Yeah, those are good questions there.
Or the first person to break out a card to check out your book.
Yeah,
by the way,
yeah.
Keep this on your person at all times if you want to take a book home with you.
And, you know, you do make a good point. 100 books in 1833 is a lot. I doubt there's very many people in the world that read 100 books in 1833 right. in their lifetime. And then in 1890, 6,000 books. That is actually a fairly large library, I would think, in 1890.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. It does make me wonder what subject matter were they curating? Was this a lot of fiction? Was this a lot of how-to type books to be able to do different tasks around the home? I'd love to know what the titles looked like and the subject matter.
Yeah, I don't think there were Encyclopedia Britannica books around at that time. So, yeah, I don't know if there were a lot of how-to books even. I think there is a lot of fiction, a lot of entertainment, maybe a little historical. I would say probably a mix between historical and fiction. It would probably be the bulk of the books there.
And, you know, you make that comment in jest, and it's funny, but it does make me wonder, when did the Britannica Encyclopedia, and I only use that name because it's the oldest one that I'm aware of off the top of my head, when did the first encyclopedia set come out to where people really could go through, use a glossary to look up a particular subject matter that they were interested in? I guess that's sort of along the lines of what you said earlier with the Dewey Decimal System and being able to go look up a title or a subject matter and pull that from the masses on the shelves that you have at your disposal.
Okay, as you were saying that, I looked it up and I'm not very smart. Technically, the first, I guess, natural history encyclopedia was first century AD, 37 chapters covering natural history, architecture, medicine, geography, geology, and all of that. The first biographies including people were 1700. So maybe they did have encyclopedias there. I could be wrong.
What about the newspaper on a long wooden stick?
Oh, yeah. When did that come in? Yes. Just here to look at the newspaper.
For some reason, we had to make it as inconvenient as possible by putting yes. it on this thing.
That long, I forgot about that. I refused to look at anything on that long wooden stick. It was so, so odd and uncomfortable to use. On that, thanks for joining us on another edition of Cool Stuff Ride Home. Connect with us via email at coolstuffcommute@gmail.com. Also, like us and leave a review on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. I'm Reggie Rizzou. He's Marcus Path. We'll be back with more cool stuff tomorrow.